The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
Hey, it's Sam Ekstrom, host of the Don't Dread the Spread podcast on the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Myself, along with my partner in crime, Sam Verhulst, will guide you through the treacherous yet exhilarating world of sports betting. And we'll even branch out into politics and pop culture once in a while. Hey, you can bet on anything. Follow us on Twitter at Sam Sports Picks. Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. It's Don't Dread the Spread. Turn your nickels into dimes.
I got one thing to read before we bring on our guest here. I got two cats at home. You know, I like to take care of them. So Pets Life, a company that we've been partnered with, is a Minnesota pet care company that has created an oral care product for your cat or dog that is 100% natural, 100% safe, and 100% guaranteed to improve, your pet's oral health. Save hundreds in vet bills and improve your pet's health by visiting PetsLife.com. That's PETZLife.com. Enter the promo code OMAHA, as in the second part of Cold Omaha, and save 20% on every online order. Or mention OMAHA for 20% off any phone order. That's PetsLife.com, spelled with a Z. PETZLife.com. Back here again for Midwest Swing. This is episode number 24. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon_Warren. You can find Midwest Swing at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network, which you can find at Cold Omaha MN. I am joined, as I have been now for a few weeks in a row, by co-founder of Cold Omaha, Tom Schreier. You can find him at T Schreier on Twitter. Tom,
three.
How's it going?
You put a three at the end of my...
Oh, there's a three. That's right. T Schreier 3, yeah. Because there's been a couple before you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. It was kind of funny. I pulled up in the truck and was behind you to get into the building. You let me in because you got the credentials and everything. And so I kind of in a hurry and I voice text, I'm out back. And I usually don't look. I'll just hit send.
Yeah.
This time I looked and it came out, I'm a bad boy. And I'm like, wow.
It's too early in the morning for that.
Yeah,
I'm
glad that it didn't go up. But anyway... Let's not belabor the point. The Twins are in Chicago. They're coming off a series in New York City. And we've got a familiar friend on the line, Dan Hayes from CSN Chicago. Dan, how are we doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. Dan has been a real good resource for getting to know guys in the Chicago media corps. Obviously, you know, Chicago's in Minneapolis quite frequently. Dan, I wanted to ask you, where does Target Field rank for you as far as opposing parks to go visit over the course of your season?
It's a top six for sure. I never really try to go in too in-depth on two through one is AT&T, two is PNC, and then three, four, five, six, they're so all close together. But I mean, it's right there on the heels of those two anyways. It's such a good place, and Minneapolis is probably one of my favorite places to go. So I mean, I feel actually pretty lucky in this division with that and KC as road travel sites to go to, just because everything's so easy in those two towns. And yeah, it's a great park, man. I mean, I everything about it's a good setup, and the press box is actually one of the better ones in baseball too.
Yeah, it's funny. I've heard great things about San Fran and Pittsburgh, like you've said, and a number of the visiting writers. You know, I try to get to know new ones every time a team is in town, have been complimentary of both the park and of Minneapolis, the city. I know Chris, I'm going to botch this last name, I think it's Ayotte, the writer for Detroit, who actually is now no longer covering the team, was very complimentary of the city. Even Joe Cowley, who I know is very polarizing as a beat guy for the White Sox, I think he actually lived part-time in Minneapolis and was very complimentary.
He still does, I believe.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, so he, in fact, when I met him, he couldn't have been anything but nicer. It was kind of funny how there was that dissonance between his public persona and how he treated me as someone who he didn't need to treat well at all, just based on, you know, not being a real well-known writer or anything. But, you know, I thought, you know, great city, and I enjoy it too, and I like to hear how, you know, visiting writers view it. And I think you're right, too. You know, Kansas City is obviously well-regarded, not a park that I've visited yet. So, yeah, two of the other four are at least very, very nice, which has got to be good. So The Twins are coming to town, starting the series today. Run down the matchups here. Jose Quintana and Kyle Gibson tonight. Ricky Nolasco and James Shields going on game two, and then wrapping it up with Tommy Malone and Carlos Rodon before the Twins head back home. First of all, I want to ask, so the White Sox come into this series 38-38, right on 500, 7.5 games out of first place. Twins markedly worse at 24-51, 21 games out of first place. Only one other team that far out of first, so that's the Cincinnati Reds, believe it or not, but the Cubs are running away with, you know, basically that division and best one-loss record in the entire National League. The Giants got three more losses. Also, we're going to have a Cubs guest on in the second half of the show, so get excited for that. But what's the vibe around this White Sox team right now, Dan? You know, it's a team where I brought this up here. It's 17-8 in April, 21-30 since, and you know their skid has kind of become, you know, at the forefront of how people are talking about them. What's going on with this team right now?
Yeah, they even were out as good as 23-10 as of May 10th, and
wow.
Then they mirrored it and went 10-23 their next 33, and all of a sudden they're sitting there at 36-36. Now, the last couple of days have actually been good because they went on the road to the Red Sox and they took 3 of 4. They should have actually swept that, and then they beat the Blue Jays 2 of 3, and they're lost there. They hit 7 home runs and rallied from being down by 5 runs 2 times and nearly came back all the way. So, you know, it's been a weird year. I mean, the way they played early on was so perfect. Everything was going their way, whether it was getting the clutch hit with 2 outs. The defense was solid. It wasn't spectacular, but it was actually spectacular with Adam Eaton in right field.
Mm-hmm.
And the bullpen was immaculate. I mean, the bullpen had a 179 or a 170 ERA through April, and they were unhittable. They were just doing everything right. But I think part of it's the fact that they've just played a ton of games that have been close the whole way. I think, counting up yesterday, 41 of their games of their 76 have been decided by 2 runs or fewer, and they've played the second or third most one-run games in baseball. And that's just their relief pitchers are constantly in high-leverage spots the whole way, and we've seen that really catch up to them. Zach Duke, as of Sunday, was leading the majors in appearances, and Matt Albers, who was off to a great start, has just completely tired out. That really has hurt them a lot, and so they've fallen off a little bit. Obviously, their starting pitching kind of was smoke and mirrors early on, too. Matt Latos got off to a great start. He was 4-0 with a .74 ERA, but he was getting away with stuff. You know, his contract rate was too high, and all of a sudden that started turning into base hits, and he started walking guys, and all of a sudden he had a 7.25 ERA over his last 7 before they DFA'd him. John Danks did not pitch well in his 4 starts, and they DFA'd him. And, you know, that stuff has caught up to him. And basically they're at a point where they were basically needing Jose Quintana or Chris Sale to go 7 innings each time. And that really hurt them because the bullpen just couldn't hang with the amount of work being thrown its way. They've lost 3 guys already. Out for the season. 2 are out for the season for sure, but Zach Putnam is probably going to join them shortly. He's weighing surgery as an option. So when you're down to your 10th and 11th and 12th relievers in that bullpen, you know, it gets really trying. And offense has been better but inconsistent. Jose Abreu hasn't had a very good season. Todd Frazier has mostly just been a home run guy. So there's a lot of swing and miss in that lineup, and it's depth is definitely kind of caught up with them.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the bullpen, I think there's a fine line. You know, you want your guys to be battle-tested, but at some point you just get worn out. You can't pitch that many high-pressure, blood pressure-boiling situations where, you know, before you start burning guys out. The Twins have been in that situation, not so much with the high pressure, but with guys throwing you know, on pace to throw 90.
Bad starters.
Yeah, on pace to throw 90, 95, even 100 innings. And these are some of the Twins' better relievers: Ryan Pressly, Trevor May before he was injured.
Abad,
Michael Tonkin has been pretty good for them. And so, yeah, you know, you can burn through a bullpen pretty fast. And, you know, guys feel good. They feel dependable. They feel like they can bounce back in April and May. But June, July, when it starts getting hot, you know, that's an issue. I did want to ask you about the offense because I'm trying to get a gauge for the identity of it. And there's some guys having, you know, pretty nice seasons, in fact, and maybe not the guys that I think people would have expected to be the pillars. Melky Cabrera, who seems to be kind of an every other year guy. Adam Eaton's turned into a really nice player. You know, not a ton of power, but enough extra base hits, take some walks. Real scrappy guy at the top of the order. And then even, you know, Brett Lowry's been okay. Jose Abreu, not quite up to snuff, but still, you know, better than average. And yeah, Todd Frazier's kind of an interesting 201 average, 302 on base. You know, that's quite an isolated discipline there. But the offense, what's the identity of this offense right now, and how has it evolved so far here as we head into the later part of June?
Yeah, it's been really inconsistent. It's funny, Sunday was their first win by three runs or more since I think May 13th. We looked at that last night. I mean, they've done just enough, but you know, at one point they had this stretch where everybody was, you know, they say hitting is contagious. Well, everybody was walking, and it was amazing. I mean, at one point, I want to say in mid-May, the White Sox were third in the American League in walks, and I think the on-base has dropped as a team to 315. This isn't a group that really does that. You look across the board, Alex Avila and Adam Eaton and Melky Cabrera are pretty much the on-base guys there. Abreu can get there, but he, you know, his pitch selection was just missing for the first 6 weeks of the season.
Yeah, he has fewer walks than Brett Lowry. That's pretty telling.
Yeah, exactly. And so you looked at the group and how were they getting that many walks? It was hard to define. At one point, you know, Austin Jackson got hurt earlier this month, and he's out for 6 weeks minimum. And at one point, he had their most consistent plate approach in the lineup, and that's not a guy who his track record is very much, you know, he's not a very big high on base guy, and he was their best approach, taking eight pitch at bats and along that line. And so it's been strange. They've been a little bit hotter of late, and part of that is Tim Anderson, who yet again is another guy who is not really a on base guy. He's very aggressive. He doesn't have a walk yet. So
24-0 walk to strikeout to walk.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. But you look at the one thing, he's been on base 20 times. He's scored 13 of them because of speed. Mm-hmm. He's got a little bit of power. And with him batting leadoff, they've had Adam Eaton hitting second. Eaton's become much better since he's gone in the second spot. And it's kind of, you know, generated some offense that they haven't had. But they're really, you know, Justin Morneau, they're going to get him in a few weeks when he comes off the disabled list. They need him. They need that patience in the middle of the lineup, somebody to break it up. I mean, the one thing that's been very strange is, you know, to say that Adam LaRoche would be a defining factor this year is strange, but Melky Cabrera would have been hitting second all along in front of Abreu had Adam LaRoche been here, because they desperately needed that left-handed bat in the middle of the lineup. So Melky batted fifth, and when Frazier and Abreu weren't getting on base very much, Melky wasn't doing much other than getting singles and getting on. And, you know, then you get to the middle of the lineup and Garcia and Lowry just aren't big on base guys either. I mean, it's been a very trying year, I could say, probably because the pitching staff has, you know, kept them in a ton of games, and the offense just hasn't been coming through. They'll have spurts where they'll have like a 2 to 3 week window where everything is great. They're scoring 6-7 runs, and then they'll go into this rut. And it happened particularly against the division. And obviously, Cleveland can do that to teams, but Cleveland got them started on a downward spiral a little bit and kept them quiet, and then the offense, you know, from probably May 20th or maybe 24th all the way till, I don't know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, it was very rough. And that's what the point when they DFA'd Jimmy Rollins, they brought up Tim Anderson. It's gotten a little bit better, but at the same time, it's just been up, down all the way, and definitely has been a reason why they've been in so many close games all season.
When they signed Austin Jackson, I kind of opined it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it was a good move to get the outfield kind of laid out how you'd like it. Get Avisaíl Garcia out of the outfield. You can have him DH since LaRoche decided not to come back or opted to not come back. But how did that go when Jackson was healthy? I mean, you got Cabrera, Jackson, Eaton in the outfield. Was that a pretty good alignment when everything was going right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at Adam Eaton, and I think he still leads the majors in defensive run saves. I know he as of Saturday has the most outfield assists in baseball. Putting Eaton from center to right made him into a Gold Glove type outfielder. I mean, and it was saving the team a ton. I mean, you could point to a bunch of games where Eaton made a defining catch. And Jackson wasn't spectacular in center, but his communication was great and would have Eaton in the right spot. Melky was playing really well. And immediately when he went down, Eaton goes to center. And Eaton was fine in center himself, but it left them exposed because Garcia had been right. And Garcia came in and botched a couple balls in a series against Detroit and has not been back in the field very much since. They've gone to the point where now J.V. Shuck is playing center just to have a defensive glove out there. And his bat's not very good, although he's hit two home runs, his first home runs in a couple seasons the last 2 days. But, I mean, you know, Jackson was perfect in that way. I mean, they just needed someone to come in and be another major league average player. And I think that the way he was hitting with his defense, he was going to be that before the year ended. You look at the last 11 games before he got injured, and he was hitting .385 and actually was starting to find himself at the plate a little bit, and things actually looked good on that front. Like I said, he was probably their most consistent plate approach at that time, and it has definitely hurt them. Their lack of depth was going to be something that hurt them this season if they were injured at all, and when Abreu is not hitting the way he is, that's popped up and hurt them too. It's been trying since Jackson went down. They're going to get I think they get another opinion on him here in the next 7 to 10 days to see what his timeline might be. He had surgery for a meniscus tear, and we'll see it coming up because they could use him back. And it's funny, if they can hang it where they are around 500 and get him and Justin Morneau there in mid to late July, they actually feel pretty good about their chances still for a wild card spot.
What are your honest-to-goodness expectations? You said mid-July for Morneau, but honestly, what are you expecting from him production-wise at this stage of the game?
I mean, if he can be a guy that comes in and even hits .280 with low power, it doesn't matter. They need someone in the middle of the lineup that can just kind of keep the innings going. Mm-hmm. And you know, they've actually done – yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that they don't have. I mean, you look at the bottom of the lineup, and Garcia's been, you know – below average, and just hasn't developed. It's the same thing kind of with Arcia. It just hasn't happened the way they thought it would. And if they can get him out of the lineup more often, put a lefty in there. I mean, that's the one thing. You know, LaRoche being there, they're 19 of 20. I think at one point it was 19 of the 20 starting pitchers on other teams in the division were right-handers. Wow. And they kept Jerry Sands. The reason why they kept him to start the season was because last year they struggled so badly against left-handers. Well, there was only one left-hander. I think it was Danny Duffy at one point, and that was the only opposing left-hander other than guys on the White Sox. And so when you don't have that left-handed bat for the middle lineup, it really killed them. So if Morneau can just stretch it, and, you know, I mean, you look at what he did the last 2 years, it's not all world, but he was hitting above .300, and granted, it was in Colorado. But
right.
You wonder how much target field messes with left-handed hitters. I mean, I've seen it.
Jason Kupel said it did.
Yeah. I covered the Padres for 5.5 years at Petco Park.
And, yeah.
And that right center gap, it just screwed with guys' heads so much. I mean, you would have somebody coming in who's a great line drive hitter to the left side, and balls just hang up there. Well, obviously, power is muted in right field. And when Joe Mauer and Morneau are your guys, that's a tough way to go. So I wonder, I still think there's something there, and he's excited. I mean, talking to him a couple times, he really thinks there's a chance that he can come back and be productive. Like I said, if he's 280, 270, and just can drive in runs and provide a little protection, that's really all they need.
Well, I know in an otherwise down year, Twins fans I think they'll at first be a little bit uncertain about it, but I think they'll warm up to the idea of him having, you know, one last go-around or, you know, wherever his career goes from here. I think he's 35 years old or getting close to it. So, you know, not a long timeline left. So he can chase, you know, whatever success he can still find at this point. One left-hander that the Twins won't face, obviously the big trio of lefties for the White Sox, is Chris Sale. And if you look at his numbers, you obviously it's a pitcher the Twins would kill to have. But I think as a more than casual observer, I've kind of seen him having a quote-unquote a little bit of a down year. And the reason is, strikeouts down, and you know, it just seems like he's getting hit a little bit more than usual. What have you seen from him? Because when I went into his pitch effects profile, you know, the swinging strikes on most of his pitches are down. Is he, you know, evolving as a pitcher and kind of coming down as far as nastiness, or is this just a stretch, or am I just kind of making something out of nothing?
Well, no, he's definitely tried to kind of, he knows he can't survive being the 96 guy all game. It really caught up with him a lot last year at the end of the season. And so he's reduced velocity a little bit, but it's been entirely intentional. You know, I think the one good thing that one of the really good things that Alex Avila has brought to them is the having been with a bunch of these guys, with Justin Verlander, with Max Scherzer at the peak of their careers, and then seeing them evolve over time. And I think there's just sort of been this decision by Sale to work more on getting pitchers to hit his pitches and try to get quick outs. And it's funny, it hasn't worked totally as what they'd like to do, because he's only thrown 12 fewer pitches this year than he did last year. Part of that might be the fact that Avila and Deonner Navarro, have actually lost them a bunch of strikes. The lower half of the strike zone has disappeared just because their pitch framing mm-hmm. isn't, you know, you go from Tyler Flowers, who was, I think, third in the majors last year, to two guys who are in the bottom five. Yeah, and I don't know that White Sox fans got how important that was, but, I mean, I would imagine right now that we'd see Sale probably somewhere around 80 pitches lower, 70 pitches lower than he's thrown already. I mean, I remember one game against the Twins last year where Flowers got him 9 strikes that were balls, and they were, a few of them were pretty far out, and that was one of the early ones where the Twins just crushed Sale. You know, I think it was a May start, and he threw 109 pitches, he threw 59 strikes, and at least 9 were balls. It was an awful strike ratio. And as far as Sale, I actually think he's been pretty good. The strikeouts are down, but you look at the numbers, they're actually a little bit better by maybe 4 or 5 points of ERA mm-hmm. than they were exactly at this time last year. You know, he's been the one guy that's getting runs scored for them, but, you know, he's pitched really deep into a lot of games this year, and that's exactly what they need. It hasn't been quite as dominant for sure, because the strikeouts are down about 35 or 40 from this point last year. But at the same time, he's given them exactly what they need. And on Sunday, the bullpen was just shot. They'd, you know, the day before, I think, I can't remember who the starter was Saturday, but they, you know, 6 innings from the bullpen or 5 innings from the bullpen, and they just had to manage their way through it. And so the Sale came through and basically gave all their guys another day off. David Robertson had to get up in the 9th and close it out, because Sale gave up 2 solo shots in the 8th, but you know, for him to go 8, and he's got a couple complete games early in the season, he's had a very good year. It's been on par. If mm-hmm. he could be a little bit better in the division, we'd be talking about a runaway Cy Young winner right now. But the division is really always getting to him. You look at his starts against KC and Detroit and Cleveland and the Twins to an extent, and there's got to be some kind of mindset change for him, because he's not quite as good in division. And if he was, we'd be definitely talking about a Cy Young winner potentially last year, and definitely somebody who would be the front runner this year. I still think he is the front runner right now, but it's a lot closer than it probably would be.
Now, I don't care about pitcher wins so much, but is Jose Quintana going to win more than 9 games this year?
Man, I'll tell you, one person who cares about pitcher wins much is Jose Quintana. Man, I mean, he started out 5-1, was having a great season. And then the offense just stopped scoring for him.
Yeah, 10 runs in the last 7 starts prior to this last one.
Yeah, and you look at his losses. Is he 5-8? Is
five
that right?
7. 7, yep.
5-7. In those 6 losses, it's been like, I think, 5 runs total. 2 shutouts for sure, and then 5 one-run games. It just seems like every time that he has the worst luck. And it's funny, the first 7 starts when he went 5-1, they scored 25 runs for him in those. And it was like, it's like the skies opened up, and it was just, you know, it was beautiful for him. I mean, this is the guy that has pitched so effectively the last couple of years. And it's a great thing that people pay attention to peripherals with him, because he's been such a value and such an asset to them. And I think that it's basically known now, you know, 10, 12 years ago, we would have thought, potentially, he was not very good.
Right.
But when now it's, you realize the value in a guy like that, and hopefully it turns around for him, because he had some great luck early on, and he was excited about it, and he's a guy that never gets down no matter what. I mean, he just says, I got to do better next time, and focuses on his next start. And so if you go based off the personality, this guy is an absolute winner, and yet his record, you know, it'd be great for him to get to 10 wins. He really wants it. He'd love to be above 500. If there's a more deserving guy in baseball, it'd be hard to find, because he just keeps going at it, and he should have been an all-star at least once or twice in his career, and yet again, he'll probably get snubbed.
With Rodon, who is going in the finale of the series, actually, he's cut the walks down, but now the hits are up. What's going on with him this season?
He's been all over the place. Early on, he was trying to do what Chris Sale was doing. He was trying to locate with a little bit less velocity and, mm-hmm. and be a command guy. And he got away from who he was, and it hurt him. And the last, I want to say, seven starts, ERA is somewhere under 3.25. It was 3.25 going into the last one. He gave up two runs and six. So, you know, when you look at him, he's throwing the fastball a lot harder lately, and it's set up his slider more. And that's who he needs to be, at least for right now. He cannot try to be the pitcher. He needs, you know, he's a stuff guy. That's what got mm-hmm. him to the majors yep. as quick as possible. And he got away from that early on. And he even talked about it. I mean, I remember talking to Avila at one point, and Avila saying, you know, his best slider hasn't shown up. He can't command it right now. And for him to be a guy that can't get the slider over early on in the year, that's his best weapon. He says his fastball is, and it's really close either way. But obviously, the slider is what everybody was kind of fawning over when he was on the way up, and it's finally started to come back. But now he's kind of working with against efficiency. I mean, he's got high pitch counts in short starts, and you know that's the one part that needs to be the next step is getting there and getting seven innings instead of six. But at the same time, they knew it was going to be a growing year for him, and so. I think they're willing to accept this this development for sure. I mean, he was sort of the X factor where he did what Bauer has done the last couple times out right. for the Indians. You know, it takes guys like with that kind of stuff a little bit of time to develop and figure it out. And it's been a good last month or two for Rodon after some early struggles. But at the same time, you look at – I'd say there have been quality starts in all but three of his games and – You know, if they knew going in they were going to get that, they probably would take it.
All right, the last thing I want to ask you before I let you go, it's kind of a loaded, multi-layered question here, but when you go and get a guy like James Shields, it's kind of, I think, cemented the concept that they're going to have to do whatever it takes between now and July to continue to try shoot for something this year. And maybe yeah. I'm reading that wrong. You can let me know. He's facing Ricky Nolasco in Game 2 of the series, a couple of guys in the offseason that were change of scenery candidates based on salary and situation around them, and neither did in the offseason. Now Shields has, maybe Nolasco still will. But what's been kind of your evaluation of Shields, which I know probably isn't very good, and two, how does acquiring him change what they do coming up here in late July with the deadline coming up?
Well, for sure it has not gone very well. The other day he went 5 against Boston, and that was encouraging just based off of he saw the career numbers, and he is pretty awful against the Red Sox, and he's even worse at Fenway Park. And yeah. for him to go 5 against the Red Sox and give up 3 runs, I'm sure they were overjoyed in the front office because the previous couple with the White Sox had been just horrible. I mean, 3 starts, 8 2/3 innings, 9 walks. NASA's still counting the hits up and the runs scored. It was, you know, he had a 21. It was like a 21.82 ERA going into Fenway, and you could just see that being a disaster. And finally, he kind of some of the stuff that he and Don Cooper worked on mechanics wise, it started to pay off. We saw a lot more pitches down in the zone for him, and so it's made some progress. There needs to be a lot more made. I mean, we're talking about a guy that they basically have committed to, and yeah, I mean, you look at. You're right. When you bring him on, you're kind of saying we're going for it. And they'd made all kinds of moves like that. I mean, they released John Danks to bring up Miguel Gonzalez. They released Matt Latos to get Shields. They released Jimmy Rollins and brought up Tim Anderson. They've made all these moves that have made kind of big statements about what they want to do this year.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't know that they can do a whole lot more before that trade deadline, just because they don't have a ton of pieces. I mean, Tim Anderson is obviously their shortstop of the future. So there's one of their two best prospects off the board. And Carson Fulmer, they love, and I don't know that they want to trade him. I think they want to hang on to him. The one thing they've talked about is kind of trying to sustain this and be able to bring from within. And if they start trading away some more, it's going to be difficult. So I think that's why they signed Morneau, is that they hope that if they couldn't go out and get a left-handed bat somewhere, that Morneau could potentially come in and be that guy at a low-cost move. Shields, you know, the thing is they have to work with him because he's going to be here for 2 years after this. Mm-hmm. So it's critical that he keeps going. And, you know, that's hopefully for their sakes, he can build off that last one. The one thing that was a good sign was there was a lot of weak contact, a lot of pop-ups to the middle infield, shallow outfield. And that's a good sign for him. He threw more strikes. He didn't throw enough strikes. He, you know, walked two guys in his last inning. But I think when they made that move, they looked at him and said, well, we're getting him for $10 million next year and $10 million the year after that. And looking what's out there on the free agent market, they didn't think they could get that.
Right.
You know, you look at Ian Kennedy getting $5.75 for a guy who is probably a 4 ERA pitcher, and J.A. Happ gets $12 million a year. It definitely was a move where they were looking not just this year, but to the future. And that's why it's critical that they get him fixed up and to at least the point where he's a 4 ERA guy for 180 innings, because that's what they need from him. And so getting him back on track is a big deal.
Well, Dan, thank you. We kept you longer than promised, and sorry about that, but I know you got to get ready to get out to the sale here to cover the Twins and White Sox later today. Enjoy that game, enjoy the series, and we'll see you back at Target Field here pretty soon.
All right, cool. Thanks for
having
me, guys.
Hey, Tom, did you know that we have a setup with Amazon where you go to coldomaha.com/Amazon and you can actually support the network?
Is that true?
Yeah. So if you go to coldomaha.com/Amazon or just click on any of the banners on coldomaha.com or the individual podcast sites or the individual places where we write and all that, you can go to Amazon. It's basically exactly the same, but it does give us a little bit of a kickback so you can support us, give us a couple extra pennies off of your Amazon site. Nothing will change for you whether you use Amazon Pantry, Amazon Prime, any of the great Amazon services that you've grown accustomed to. So go to coldomaha.com/Amazon. Again, nothing will change for you, but you can help support us and everything we do here at coldomaha.com. All right, that was Dan Hayes. Tom, have you talked to Dan at all?
I don't think so.
Guy that reached out, he was real good to talk to.
Yeah,
and it's fun to get to meet the other writers. You and I have met a few other writers from other markets. Anthony Fennick,
yeah,
or Fennich. I keep doing that wrong, even though you know we're buds. I just can't remember.
It's a weird spelling.
So we're looking forward to talking to him again at some point here when he's back in town. We do have Matt Trueblood coming on here in just a minute from BP Wrigleyville and Baseball Prospectus. I trust that he'll be calling in here in just a minute or two. Yeah, we're just waiting on him right now, Tom. So
we've talked to him before. He's great.
Yeah, he is great. And so we've had him on before, and I think Matt, we got you.
Great.
How are we doing, Matt? You doing good?
Yeah, doing well.
Well, you're on the air. We got you live, and we're gonna drop you in the deep end and have you swim here. How? Coming off a pretty historic night for the Chicago Cubs with Chris Bryant, what was your takeaway? 5 extra base hits last night. I believe it was, 3 home runs, 2 doubles?
Yeah, which no one had ever done before.
Ever, yeah. In the play index era, now that we can actually look these things up quite easily, no results. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, it's insane. Bryant is so special, and it's amazing to see the way he's capable of changing. I remember when he came up to the big leagues and you could see all the raw power in the swing. Obviously it's in the body, it's in the mm-hmm. swing plane, but he was cutting himself off and his best power was to the opposite field. But because of that, a lot of it was going for doubles. He was very patient. He was working a lot of walks, but not driving the ball a ton. And he's really figured out how to adjust where, you know, there's not, he's taken the lid off of, you know, whatever ceiling he had, he's blowing his way through it. Now, the league's going to make more adjustments to him, and
sure,
he'll have to adjust back, but it is something to see.
Now, I'm going to go off the rails a little bit here. I'm sure it won't surprise you too much, but the Cubs actually do not have the most wins in baseball. How surprised are you at that at this point? And we got Texas coming into Minneapolis this weekend. In fact, I wrote the scorecard excerpt that'll be on sale at Target Field. I'm very excited to see this Rangers team. But are you surprised at what the Rangers have done? And you know, what have you thought of that so far?
Yeah, I am surprised. And I should caveat that with the fact that I think when we did preseason picks at Baseball Prospectus, mm-hmm. all of our staff picking picking everybody. The Rangers were like the second most popular World Series pick. I can't explain that for you. That's other people. But it definitely surprises me to see them here, given sort of the corners they've backed themselves into with a few bad financial ideas.
Yeah, two of their worst contracts are Shin Soo Chu and Prince Fielder, who are huge.
Right.
I mean contracts, not body types.
And there's not necessarily anything wrong with the deal that they made for Yu Darvish, but they're not getting anything out of him this year.
Right.
And still somehow they're doing what they're doing. Now, all that said, they're not as good as their record.
Right.
And that's probably going to even out in time. You know, we expect that just statistically. But, they're an interesting team, and they always have so much high-ceiling young talent that when it hits, the way it's hit for Nomar Mazara this year, it can be really, they can surprise you pretty easily that way.
Well, and even the impossibly young Jerickson Profar, who's, they're kind of scrambling to find playing time between first and DH and second and third, kind of moving them all over the place. Ian Desmond has been quite a find for them in free agency and is going to embolden, I think, an entire new generation of general managers to sign infielders and move them to the outfield, something that Twins fans will openly lament.
Oh my God.
Haven't seen how that's gone. But it's been a fun season. I'm looking forward to seeing them come into town. And the connection that I saw was when I was looking at games back margins and see the Cubs have a 10-game lead over second place St. Louis. The Rangers have a 10-game lead over second place Houston. I believe surging Houston, I might add. But it's a little surprising to see teams with 10-game leads at this point. Do you feel like the Cubs, with a 10-game lead, are very safe, or have you had any gripes lately? I know if you read Twitter, Cubs fans will gripe over just about anything. But where are you at with this Cubs team at this point?
Yeah, well, there's kind of a few things to say. One is that while they no longer lead the league in wins, they still have the best record in baseball. They have three or four fewer losses than the other teams that are with them. So they couldn't be playing a whole lot better. The main thing to notice is that this really is a diminished team right now. Mm-hmm. They are down from the team they envisioned at the beginning of the season. Kyle Schwarber, Jorge Soler, Dexter Fowler, Tommy La Spella, and they really only have a shadow of Miguel Montero right now. He's not healthy.
He's
not himself behind the plate. Given all of that, they may still be the best team in baseball. It's not by the margin that we thought it might be. But this is still a really, really good team. The pitching has experienced some regression that they were due for, frankly. I think we all knew that the true talent level of every starting pitcher in their rotation was not an ERA south of 2.5. And the bullpen is what the Cubs do with bullpens. They spend their resources elsewhere, make themselves very good in every other area, and then they'll patch together a bullpen. It's worked well enough so far. It could certainly work better. And Cubs Twitter, they can't handle not having a dominant bullpen.
True.
But a dominant bullpen just isn't, it's the least valuable asset you could have as a team trying to make it to the playoffs and make it to the playoffs in great position to succeed there. So if that comes together, great. But I don't think the Cubs are, hand over the panic button, waiting for one more blown save before they go and trade something stupid for Andrew Miller.
Well, and so it's been one of those deals where they've been so embattled by injuries. You can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it looks to me like they had to go out and get Chris Coughlin again, or how do you say that? Coughlin?
Yeah, Coughlin.
And so they went out and got him. What did you think of that trade? That one completely went under the radar for me, and that Arismendi Alcantara had been sent to the A's. Did you like that trade? Or I know Alcantara was on the radar for a while and then kind of vanished after a rough season down in Iowa. What was your takeaway from that trade, and do you think he's going to be a valuable piece for the team the rest of the year?
Yeah, Alcantara, I think, is pretty clearly the thing that everyone thinks the Cubs don't have, which is a prospect that just didn't pan out.
Right.
You never know what he could put together. He's still a good base runner. He's a good fielder when he has his head right, but he doesn't always. But he just can't handle good changeups, can get sequenced into a whole lot of swing and miss at the big league level, and is even starting to back up in AAA. So they gave up very little. for that, they brought back a guy who played terribly in Oakland, mm-hmm. or at least had terrible results in Oakland.
Right.
But a guy who has this long history of low, low lows and pretty high highs. I mean, he was a three-win player for the Cubs. He's a really good hitter. He's a good leader in the clubhouse. He's a guy who has kind of been through a lot. Teams haven't really trusted him throughout his career for reasons legitimate and otherwise. And I think it was certainly worth a shot to bring him back and see if stabilizing and saying, hey, we still liked you. You know, we got rid of you because those are the circumstances in February. But we still believe in what you can do. See if that boosts him into something. And he has played pretty well since arriving. I don't know if it's a permanent engagement or not. They're going to have a fascinating roster crunch,
right,
if people really get healthy in the near future here. But, you know, it was definitely worth what they expended to get it done.
It seems like he's the quintessential Joe Maddon player. He's played four different defense positions this year, as many as five in the past. Only two, each of the outfield corners so far for the Cubs, but it's been just a couple weeks here since they acquired him. But when I look at this Joe Maddon roster right now, even embattled by injuries, it's fascinating to me how he's used some of these guys. And it looks to me like he's managed to get his bench guys in enough that they've played well. Albert Almora's got decent numbers. David Ross looks reinvigorated at 39. Even Javier Baez, you know, he's doing okay. Matt Caesar, is it Caesar? I never ever know how to say that one either.
Yep.
Caesar's doing okay.
Yep, Caesar.
It seems like he's kept guys involved enough, you know, moving pieces around. I know Chris Bryant's played. He's played a little bit of outfield too, I believe, and some guys have kind of moved around. Is his day-to-day lineup, you know, one of the more entertaining things for Cubs fans?
I think for Cubs fans, just given their natural disposition, his day-to-day lineup is one of the more excruciating things.
Yeah.
But it's fun for those of us who can keep a low temperature from day-to-day. I mean, he's got
a
whole lot of pieces, a lot of different, you know, he's very good at managing incoming information. He's going to listen to his fielding instructors, the coaching staff, the front office is sending down data on matchups and stuff like that. So he can make different decisions every single day. And I think that's, honestly, and I don't know how long it's going to take, but I think that's the future of position player deployment. So we're going to see fewer locked-in positions, fewer locked-in lineup slots, more proactive rest for regulars, because it makes everyone on the team better.
Now, I'm head over heels for this guy who only has 10 big league games, and I know you know where I'm going with this. Tell me about Wilson Contreras and why I should be even more excited than I am, and why everybody who isn't watching too closely should be excited about this young guy who's catching a little bit, playing a little bit outfield.
Yeah, I mean, Wilson Contreras is a sort of strange name, I know, but just translate it in your mind, it's Spanish for Kyle Schwarber.
Booyah.
He's not going to hit for as much power as Schwarber, but he's got a much better raw hit tool in that he's not going to strike out nearly as much.
Sure.
They kind of balance out that way. I think Schwarber's the better overall hitter, but Contreras provides a ton of value. He's, if anything, a better athlete than Schwarber, and Schwarber's an underrated athlete in the first place. Like Schwarber, he's a little loose in terms of the catching skills. Now, people like his future behind the plate a lot more than they like Schwarber's, in part because he's got this cannon for an arm and a quicker release. He does have a lot to work on in terms of receiving, in terms of framing, but he's good at handling pitchers. This is a guy he's 24. He's old for a rookie, but that's because he's labored all the way up through the Cubs system. He used to be a third baseman, kind of drifted without a position for a while, only became a prospect in the last year and a half or so. And along the way, he's learned English exceptionally well, mm-hmm. dedicated himself to really committing to pitchers personally. So those sort of intangible things that you need from a catcher, he's got them. And he brings enthusiasm, and they are going to be able to move him around. Like we've already seen, he's played left field and first base. So, yeah, he's basically filling just the role that Schwarber did for the Cubs last year, where there was this sort of midseason sag, injuries were taking a toll, offense was struggling, and they had this spark plug to just toss in there.
Now, before we move on to the pitching staff quickly here, I did want to ask, what's going on with Jason Hayward? His numbers don't look too great, and I know he was kind of their big splash. And I, one of my favorite players, I don't think anybody in baseball wears a baseball uniform better than he does. But what's going on with him right now?
Yeah, I'm of two minds there. Early on, he was really messed up. He was really broken, getting beat on a whole lot of things inside, unable to elevate just about anything. He has this history of being a slow starter, but this was, I think, something else. There was more to it. He's striking out at a much higher rate than he ever has before, except in the one season where he flashed a whole bunch of power, which he certainly hasn't done this year. But since the beginning of June, he's got a 343 OBP, a 404 slugging. It's not lighting the world on fire, but he's really started to turn things around. You can see him being a little quicker on those fastballs in. Pitchers have to work him a little more carefully. I think that he's going to be fine and he's going to come right around from here. It looks like that's already happening, but I'm going to reserve judgment a little bit too, because over those first 2 months, there really was something wrong.
Well, yeah, that's one of my favorite players, and so I hope, you know, obviously for good things for him. So we move to the pitching staff here a little bit. Everybody knows how great Jake Arrieta, John Lester are. Actually, they have identical ERAs, and I think, you know, based on my observation, Arrieta struggled a little bit with pitch counts and walks lately. You know, not an obscene amount, but enough to the point where I'm sure some Cubs fringe fans have gone a little crazy. But who I want to know about are the 3-4-5 guys. You know, everybody knows a lot about John Lackey. You know, he's been in the league forever. But Jason Hamill and Kyle Hendricks intrigue me. Both guys with sub-3 ERAs. In fact, Lackey is the black sheep of the bunch with a 3.29 ERA. Everybody else is under 3. What can you tell me about these back-end guys? Because I know that, you know, non-dedicated Cubs fans are not going to hone in on those guys. They're going to hone in on the Arrietas and Lesters. But these guys have to be the glue that has kept, you know, the number one ERA in the National League moving forward.
Yeah, obviously they're very different. So I'll just start with Hamill.
Oh, actually, it's amazing. These five guys have made every single start for the Cubs this year. So that's a lot of continuity.
Which speaks to the consistency with which they drill mechanics, the emphasis they put on pulling pitchers, you know, a batter or two too early rather than a batter or two too late, and the fact that they go out of their way to get guys extra rest between starts whenever possible. If there's a rain out, you're never going to see the Cubs shorten their rotation. They're in the middle of 24 straight without an off day right now, so they optioned Adam Warren to the minors to stretch him out. They're going to give him one start before the break and one start after, so everybody can get a little extra rest.
Sure.
That's one thing that makes, you know, that makes them healthier than most teams. Another is that they're just selecting pitchers with a lower health risk. You know, there is a line that you cross where if you're 31 like John Lester was when he signed and you've never had a serious arm injury, you've demonstrated durability at a level that can be trusted.
Yeah, I actually read
the
chapter.
Put such a premium on him.
I actually read the chapter about him having bone chips in the arm last night before I went to bed, and that was fascinating. The pursuit of him, and he's been an incredible perseverance story, durability story, and everything as well. But that was a fun chapter. I can't recommend that book enough. But sorry to interrupt you as you were.
No, that's fine. Yeah, and it is a great book. Watching Lester pitch is this amazing sort of almost painful art.
We've talked about this before.
He's got great stuff, but he's also almost constantly laboring. He's very determined to work the edges. David Ross kind of has to work with him as a framer and know that, you know, you've got to trust me to throw a breaking ball in a 2-1 count. I'll get you the strike. Mm-hmm. Ross is obviously basically the in charge of pickoff throws because of Lester's issues. But anyway, I was talking about Hamill and Hendricks. Hamill has always had these health issues and always had problems getting through a full season healthy. And we don't know, obviously, whether that'll change this year. What we do know is that he sort of rebuilt his off-season conditioning program using Jake Arrieta as a model this winter. He's definitely looked stronger at a lot of points, especially deeper in games. He would just start to peter out, and in particular with him, that means leaving the fastball flat and the curveball or slider up. Those things haven't happened this year. He's also, he has this killer pitch in his slider, and he's just ratcheted up the usage over the last couple of years to the point where he uses it more than all but a handful of other pitchers in baseball. Mm-hmm. And it's really just worked for him. And Hendricks, when you watch him pitch, people will think of Hendricks as finesse and kind of flaky, you know, you just hope to get him through a start. But he's capable of dominating as much as anyone other than Arrieta or Lester on the Cubs staff. He's got a wicked changeup and a sinker that isn't fast, but does have good movement, mm-hmm. and which he can locate, I mean, on pins. It's remarkable, and he repeats his delivery well. He's not as small or as kind of unathletic as he might look at first glance. Fields his position exceptionally, so he gets a ton of ground balls. He gets swings and misses on the changeup to batters of both hands because he has two different ways of throwing the changeup, depending on where, you know, what he wants to do. They're probably the best back half of any rotation in the majors, unless you want to grant the Mets perfect health, but we're seeing how troublesome that assumption is. So this is maybe one of the bigger strengths of the Cubs organization, even though you'll run into a lot of Cubs fans wringing their hands over it.
The last thing I want to ask you before we let you get back to the rest of your day is just how good is Hector Rondon, and is he underappreciated among closers? Because you look at his numbers and they just pop. 11.3 strikeouts per walk. Not 11.3 strikeouts per nine. In fact, he's above that. 1.38 ERA. Incredible numbers across the board. How fantastic is this guy?
Yeah, he's a freak. He's going back to maybe June of last year. You could see the stuff was there, but he wasn't getting a ton of strikeouts. So he had to worry just a little that maybe it was that high-velocity arm that doesn't have quite the raw stuff it looks like. We're past that concern now. He's added a changeup that he can count on against lefties. The sinker is a bowling ball, and it'll come in. He's touched 100. He's
wow.
usually going to sit 96 to 98. But, yeah, it's freakish. And then he can snap off a slider that doesn't get whiffed the way some pitcher sliders do, but almost always results in weak contact on the ground. I can't even think of a good contender for the second best closer in the National League. It's Kenley Jansen, it's Hector Rondon, it's everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Not many people think of it that way, but yeah, he's phenomenal, and the Cubs got him as a Rule 5 pick,
wow.
which says everything.
Well, Matt, thanks for joining us. I'm going to let you get back to your day. We'll have you on again real soon. But, again, thank you for taking time out. Check out Matt's work on BP Wrigleyville and BaseballPerspectives.com. And we will chat again with you real soon.
Terrific. Thanks, guys.
All right. That's been episode number 24 of Midwest Swing. Join us again next week. I think we're going to try to get Mike Berdino of the Pioneer Press back on, and that should be a lot of fun. He does a real nice job. So thanks for joining us, and have a wonderful day.
Hey guys, this is Tom Schreier, co-founder of ColdOmaha.com. Thank you for listening to the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes and leave us a comment and a rating. Also, don't forget to check out ColdOmaha.com to see all of our podcasts and read articles about your favorite teams in the Twin Cities. If you have any suggestions or comments on anything related to Cold Omaha, email us at editors@ColdOmaha.com or follow us on Twitter @ColdOmahaMN.